Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Connon. How you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Greetings to everybody in Liberation Square, Cairo, and you're on the road. We hope you succeed. And
don't forget Tunisia as well. They're still fighting in Tunisia.
Yes, and we have an expert, and, you know, when you have something good going, you stay with it. We're going to be talking to Zafar Ben-Gash, who is from Crescent International. I'll get the email up here in a moment, and we're going to be talking about the latest news, because I would think that in Canada, one among the voices most informed has got to be Zafar Ben-Gash. And his website, by the way, crescent-online.net. He should be with us shortly. I don't know. He might be with us. He's not with us yet, I don't think. let me say that again. crescent-online.net. And he has things to say about Tunisia and about developments in Egypt. There is some dramatic things going on. This is, as I said, the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. We have a website with previous broadcasts and some editorial material and just interesting articles, and that's at taylor-report.com. And I urge you to go to that, for example, to hear previous interviews with Zafar Ben-Gash, who has been following this very closely. He has a new article about both Tunisia, articles about Tunisia and Egypt. Of course, you want to be going all over the web to get your news. Isn't this great? You don't have to rely on the Toronto Star. The Toronto Star seems to be going into cloud cuckoo land. They had a feature story today about a misunderstood camel rider. you got to hand it to him. I mean, that is really deeply far-fetched silliness.
I don't comment because the article left me speechless. I mean, everybody saw what those guys and the camels were doing, right?
Yeah, we did watch them. I'd like to tell the editor to start. A lot of us watched, you know. And you realize what we've been prisoners of media for a long time. Someone from the media that we are not a prisoner of is Zafar Ben-Gash. Are you there, Zafar? Oh, he's not. Oh, I'm sorry. We will have him. So, Ed, among other things, by the way, later today we will also say a little bit about the Super Bowl. If we have a little trouble catching Zafar, we might even start with the Super Bowl. And I also have news. I want to tell you a story, Phil, about Richmond, Virginia, which is, you know, this is Black History Month. And the most important moment in black history on this continent came with the defeat of the slave-owning states. And the capital of the slave-owning states was Richmond. And it is still proudly the capital of the slave-owning states. But something is going on in the city of Richmond I want all of our listeners know about and to get involved in. So we'll be talking about that maybe sooner than I thought. I'm waiting for... I always want to say this on air. This just in. great. I appreciate that. I'm going to tell... I'll tell you what. So let us do the Cairo news. These are things we want to talk about with Zafar. One is U.S. warships are apparently approaching Egypt. And with the old banner flying, the banner of rescue, they say they're only in the area in order to rescue Americans. You know, sovereign countries don't appreciate people telling them what they're going to do. And I have to say, go to Russian television, RT.com. It's, you know, free yourselves, please. Because they've been commenting on this. They're interested in the sovereignty issue. They don't have any sympathy for Mubarak. But what they want to know is how come Obama gets to put him in and take him out as he wishes, which is a pretty good question. And if they send warships, by what right do they enter? You know, because aboard, I was once on a U.S. aircraft carrier as a U.S. Marine, and I actually got transported by a helicopter onto somebody else's territory. Well, it was called a mock war. You'll be happy to know we won. At any rate, aboard that ship are the Marines for the purposes for which the U.S. Marines were designed, which is boarding parties and landing parties. And for missions, colonial missions of this type, which is you just go to the other guy's country. You say, you don't bother to say knock, knock. What you say is we're coming in, and we advise your army to not be in front of us. And if it's a local guy who works for you, he'll get out of your way, and then you do whatever you want to do. Of course, we know the exercise historically has turned into also regime change exercises. They not only rescue their own nationals, but they transform the government, leave a local henchman behind, and come home and say mission accomplished. So it's a very serious matter. And the other issue that is we're going to be asking Zafar about is, well, who's engaged with this fight, and what are where is it going? Because we had a little meeting, and I think that confused people. Actually, these Muslim Brotherhood leaders met with the designated vice president, Mr. Suleiman, not an admired figure in Egypt. And so the question is, why did they do that? And, you know, where is this going to take us? And by the way, we've caught Zafar Benkash. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes, I am. Sorry, Phil. I was on the line with South Africa, so I couldn't sort of...
Anything you want to tell us?
I was trying to arrange an uprising there.
Yes, I thought you were behind this. That's why we were calling you. This is Zafar Benkash, crescent-online.net. Am I right?
That's correct.
Hey, let's tell you the most important thing. My lead question to you today was going to be, and I guess it will be, is America ready for democracy? Because this is a theme that we took up last week when we had you here talking about matters in Egypt and Tunisia and elsewhere. And you are bringing someone on the 12th, February 12th, at the Islamic Center.
Yes, in Richmond Hill.
And this is Cynthia McKinney, and she is ready.
Absolutely, absolutely. Cynthia McKinney would be here on February the 12th, and she's going to be talking about... She's actually right now in the Middle East, by the way. So,
let's hope we get her here.
Yes, that's right.
But isn't that the interesting question? I mean, I know of three people so far that I can name, and then I'm finished. It is Jimmy Carter has said that if we believe in democracy, we should recognize Hamas, we should recognize Hezbollah, and of course he would say that any leadership that emerges in Egypt.
In Egypt, exactly.
And Dennis Kucinich has agreed with that.
Right.
And I think Cynthia McKinney. After that, I think I've run out of fingers here.
See, this is you posed a very interesting question. Unfortunately, the U.S. is not ready for democracy. As we had mentioned the last time we spoke, America is only for democracy if it likes the winner. And mm-hmm. So it didn't like the winner in Palestine, which was Hamas. It didn't like the winner in Lebanon because it was Hezbollah. And it appears as if it is not going to like the winner in Egypt, because it's most likely, even if they don't win an outright majority, but they would win the maximum or the largest number of votes. That would be the Ikhwan al-Muslimun, or the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And somehow the Americans and the West in general have an allergic reaction to this, that they don't mm-hmm. want people in other countries to exercise their rights freely.
Yes, and let me ask you this, Zafar, because, it's very striking, and I think you made the point. The Muslim Brotherhood is, on the political spectrum, is roughly center on almost all questions.
Absolutely.
And would it be that the word Muslim itself is beyond... palatable.
I think that's what it is. That's exactly, you put your finger on it exactly. You see, if you want to look at the Muslim Brotherhood in terms of their political inclinations or affiliations, I would say that they are probably somewhere at the same level as the Justice and Development Party in Turkey. In fact, if anything, The Turkish party might be slightly more radical than the Muslim Brotherhood mm-hmm. is in Egypt. And yet, because the Turks haven't used the word Muslim or Islam in their mm-hmm. party, they're talking about, justice and development, they are more palatable.
I wonder, by the way, if the Brotherhood were to change their title, if their Western friends might be able to sell that. Although, by the way, we should note, the U.S. is not happy with Turkey.
Exactly.
And they're quick to say we have to unmask them because they say justice development, but in fact we know they're Muslims. Hey, by the way, Zafar, I have to ask you this. Hey, Turkey, and this is tied in with the Egypt whole thing, The reason, one of the reasons the Justice and Development Party, if I've got the name right, is where it is today is because Turkey, under generals and under secularists, knocked on the door of Europe and said, can we please come in? And we're told, no, the door is locked. Don't go around to the back. We've locked that one, too.
Yes.
Isn't that true? I mean,
absolutely.
They just plain didn't want people who come from an Islamic culture.
Exactly. In fact, several European leaders have said openly that we cannot allow Turkey to be part of the European Union because they are Muslims. They said it in just these plain words.
Yes.
Although Turkey is a member of NATO, you know, so the Turks are good enough if they are going to be, if they are prepared to die for...
Yes, they died in Korea.
Yeah, if they want to, you know, sacrifice their lives for protecting Western interests, that's okay. They are acceptable. Mm-hmm. But if they want to join in an economic union with Europe, then they are unacceptable because they are obviously not the kinds of people that the West...
And by the way, we have many, and we have to include the broad spectrum. And I said Kucinich and Carter and McKinney, that's it. We have many people who regard themselves as to the left of all those people, who they don't like the concept of Muslims either, and yet... The most powerful party in Europe, the, right at the center, is called Christian Democratic.
Yes.
So where is, what is it with these people who claim that, oh, you have to be secular?
Right.
Yeah, but the main, absolutely powerful right-wing party in Europe, they ruled many of those countries,
yes,
is called Christian Democrat.
So basically,
but if the Brotherhood said we are Muslim Democrat, they said, oh, no.
You can't be. Because so long as you are a Muslim, you cannot be a Democrat. These are exclusive terms. That's what they are trying to
do. They have a patent.
Absolutely.
You can't use the word because they have a patent.
But you know something? I think that the developments, the way they are taking shape in Egypt, are very exciting in the sense that over the last 2 weeks, the regime has been trying to subvert the uprising of the people, and they tried different tactics. First was to see if they could get the army to crush them. First, of course, the police, which is brutal, absolutely brutal, and of course you have the interior ministry troops, which are even more brutal than sort of police forces anywhere else in the world. And they used all their terror tactics against the demonstrators, and the demonstrators absolutely refused to be cowed down or to submit to them. Then the regime thought that they are going to send the army, which might do the thing, but the army realized that if it's going to shoot at the people, there is going to be not only massive casualties, but there is going to be a reaction from the people in such a way that the army would not be able to handle it. In fact, the army high command realized that they were going into a very untenable situation, so they backed out. And then the regime adopted the third option that they had, and that was to send their special forces, the special police forces, disguised as civilians. These people were armed, they were given machetes, they were given swords, they were given whips, and big sticks, and they rode into the crowds on horses and camels, and they started beating up people. And this was all...
By the way, as ever, I have to just say, give you an opportunity to even say something about it, but today's the front page of one of Toronto's newspapers said that was all an accident.
My God. It's incredible.
Page, there's a picture of a man kissing a camel saying he was misunderstood.
You know, the pro-democracy demonstrators managed to, despite all of these provocations and everything, they managed to grab about 350 of those people. They grabbed them, and they took their ID cards from them. And they showed them to the media that these people that had come, they were either policemen in plain clothes or they were members of the ruling party, the National Democratic Party. And just imagine, you know, how they use these words, national and democratic, when there is nothing democratic about that party. Because unless you are a member of that party, you can't even run for any office. You can't even run for the presidency.
Yeah.
So that's how democratic they are. And then the third group of people that they found was these were criminals that had been released from prisons, paid $10 each for the day, and they were promised that if they went and beat up these peaceful demonstrators, that their sentences would be commuted and they could go home. So these were the kinds of people that were unleashed against the peaceful civilians. And it is quite incredible that, you know, on the night of February the 1st, which was Tuesday night, when Mubarak spoke, when he, you know, gave that televised address, he talked about, he said that, well, initially the demonstrators were peaceful, but now you see these clashes have erupted and so on, and people are fighting each other, throwing stones and using whips and swords and machetes. But that didn't happen until Wednesday afternoon. So how did Mubarak know all of this, you know?
He can see into the future.
Exactly. So, you know, and this is how, I mean, obviously he was not supposed to have delivered that speech until Wednesday evening, but because the people refused to go away, so he was forced to bring the speech forward, and the idiots that are around him, they didn't even change his speech.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Zafar, you opened the door for me to tell you a joke. There is a joke going around in Egypt today, I understand it, in which a speechwriter does arrive in his office, lays a speech down, and goes, he's going to leave, and Mubarak says, "What is that?" And he says, "That's your farewell address to the people."
Right.
And Mubarak says, "What? The people are leaving?" And which brings me to this question. You know, I know a lawyer in New York who says to me, when he has when bad things happen, he says, "This is not my first time at the rodeo." The U.S. is, for them, they are experienced at trying to rescue bad leaders all over the world. And there is a writer who appeared in the Counterpunch just a couple of days ago. I'll find his name as we speak. But his point, what he says, he thinks they're going to try. Yeah, Ismail Al-Amin.
Right.
He says he thinks it's as likely as not their goal would be to create a Marcos-like phenomena where they get rid of, like they did in the Philippines, a figure that the whole world knew had to go, but then they managed to convince people that the army felt loved democracy, and they put somebody in, and they won there. That was a success for the U.S.
Yes, of course. Yeah, you're referring to Islam Al-Alamin, yes.
Yes.
You're right. Actually, the manner in which the current deck has been loaded, so you see, the vice president, the person that has been appointed vice president, Omar Suleiman, he's a former general, and he was from 1993 to the beginning of January, he was the intelligence chief and the most ruthless operator, a person who has been now shown, there is evidence available that he personally supervised torture of prisoners, that he personally supervised the execution of prisoners in Egyptian prisons. And even today, hundreds of demonstrators have been put in prison, and they're being brutally tortured.
Yes.
There's another person that I think we ought to, you know, mention, and that is the new interior minister, Mahmoud Wagdi. Now, he's also a former general, and he used to be in charge of prisons in Egypt. And anybody who knows anything about the prisons in Egypt would know that they are the most horrible places in the world, where all kinds of terrible things happen: torture, beatings, electrical, you know, currents being tied to people, even rape of prisoners, as well as the rape of their family members, like, you know, wives or daughters or sisters or mothers. Those are the kinds of things that are taking place in Egyptian prisons. And they set dogs upon them.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all documented. Even, in fact, the State Department has documented this. Forget about Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International and others, but even the State Department, in guarded terms, but, I mean, they have mentioned these things in their reports. And so that is the kind of person, Mahmoud Wagdi, who was in charge of prison, who has now been made the interior minister.
Yeah, at a time when, I mean, you have actually revolutionary tumult going on.
Yes.
And they're putting these really ugly characters into position. By the way, we're speaking to Zafar Benghazi, and I got to tell you, there's a very important program, Global Peace in the Age of Imperialism, a speech by former U.S. Congresswoman and presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney, And that's going to be Saturday, February the 12th at 6 p.m. at the Islamic Society of York Region, 1380 Stouffville Road, Richmond Hill. And it's there's going to be a meal served. It's $25. I urge everybody, please go. And it's, and to get tickets for the event, you call 905-887-8913. That's Cynthia McKinney, who is at this moment traveling in the Middle East. Boy, she's going to have a lot of things to tell us.
Oh, absolutely.
On,
I think, you know, the calls that
February the 12th at 6.
The calls that we are receiving from people, I mean, they're asking me. So I said, well, why don't you hold on to this? Let Cynthia tell you everything. She's there. She'll give us first-hand information, you know. So,
well, of course. I mean, and Cynthia is a very credible figure. She's one of the few American political leaders who can travel in the Middle East and has complete respect, because they know that she is a democratic person and she's not afraid of revolutionary movements in the Middle East. As a matter of fact, she's rather enthusiastic about them. We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, Crescent hyphen, oh, I got that.
Online.net.
Online. I keep wanting to say international. Crescent hyphen online.net. And Zafar, there is also dramatic news, and I wonder if you know anything about this. The PressTV.ir/live is reporting that U.S. warships are moving towards Egypt. As far as I know, that's agreed. The U.S. is even explaining that they're there for possible rescue.
That's correct. Yes, I'm aware of that. Yes, they're saying that this is for possible rescue, but obviously the people in Egypt and elsewhere are not taken in by these. In fact, there are grave forebodings expressed by the pro-democracy people in Cairo to say that, you know, we view this with great concern because the U.S. has also now publicly shifted their position. Previously, they were saying, Obama was saying and others, that they need to have the transition to begin now. Mm-hmm. And now they are saying that, well, you know, Mubarak has to stay because he's needed for stability, etc., until, you know, arrangements are made to hold elections in September. Yeah. In fact, you know, somebody joked about this fact. They said that, you know, when Mubarak says that he's not going to run in the elections, you know, we believe him because he has never run in an election. There have never been elections in Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of easy to do.
So he's not telling a lie. I mean, he's just admitting to a fact.
Yeah. That's like the time when the U.S. was negotiating with Russia about nuclear weapons, and the Soviets said, well, we want a non-aggression pact, that neither of us will be the first to use the weapons. And the U.S. said, well, that's easy for you to say. We already did it. No, this is but I would take that. You know, it's the old thing, I hear what you say, but I see what you do.
Yes.
What are you doing bringing warships close to a country that's going through a political upheaval? I don't know if we should characterize it as revolution at this point, but many are. But a foreign power with an aircraft carrier.
Absolutely.
And that's a bad sign.
This is exactly. This is a direct repudiation of the rights of the people of Egypt that have been, you know, enormously patient with what has gone on over the last 2 weeks. They've been enormously disciplined. They have not resorted to violence despite the extreme provocation. And I'm sure you must have seen on television and other photographs and so on, that many of the demonstrators actually stretched out in front of tanks and military vehicles to make sure that these tanks, etc., are not able to move to do other things. But they were prepared to sacrifice their lives right in front of the tanks, laying down over there, and even in the tank tracks they were laying down, so that, you know, these tanks are unable to move from there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the level of courage that these people have demonstrated and over the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think what is really remarkable about the uprising in Egypt and indeed prior to that in Tunisia is that these people in the Middle East have finally broken the fear barrier. And so now fear is flowing in the other direction. It is the rulers that are in fright and in flight.
Well, that's more like it.
And it, exactly. And it's the people that have lost all fear, and mm-hmm. they are able to withstand to any level of brutality that is inflicted upon them. And I think this is a very positive development. You mm-hmm. know, today the regime in Egypt announced that they were increasing salaries for all government employees by 15%. And this is a clear bribe because they want to try to buy off people's loyalty. But if there is no bread over there, if there is no safety over there, if there is no security, and the regime and its thugs have been involved in attacking banks and attacking properties and trying to loot properties, and the people know this, so the people are not taken in that easily by the kinds of tactics that the regime is resorting to.
It's unlikely that they're 15% patriots. Probably, you know, to the extent that they're 100%, 15% doesn't mean a thing.
Exactly.
I mean, they must be very, I mean, they have to be feeling very good about this. But by the way, what is the media story inside Egypt at the moment, would you know? I mean, for example, we're talking about Cairo, but there are big demonstrations in Alexandria. Is word getting, is there any broadcasting at all that where people have their own radio and that kind of thing?
I'm afraid not. The only sort of credible information that is going on is basically through personal contact. But, you know, to put this in perspective, when on February the 1st, the people, or January 31st, when they had called for a million man march on Tuesday, February the 1st, in actual fact, 8 million people throughout came out and participated in these demonstrations. So there are more than 2 million people in Cairo, 1 million in Alexandria, the second largest city, 750,000 in Suez, and you just go on naming these cities, and in fact, virtually entire populations.
By the way, we're speaking to an expert here, Zafar Bengash, and crescent-online.net, and I have to ask, there's reports of developments in the Sinai that seemed rather dramatic. A pipeline has been blown up,
etc. Exactly.
Do you not have any idea what that's all about?
That's right, exactly. That pipeline actually is the one that supplies gas to Israel. Now, 50% of Israel's gas comes from Egypt, and that pipeline was built in 1999, December 1999, so that this was part of the process of normalization that was taking place between Egypt and Israel, although the people of Egypt were opposed to this because they said that how can there be normalization of relations with Israel when it is still sitting in occupation of Palestine, when Sinai Peninsula has been demilitarized, Egypt cannot even have its army over there, and can only have a limited number of police officers. So Israel gets all the benefits, whereas Egypt and the people of Egypt get nothing. Mm-hmm. But that pipeline was built in order to supply Israel's gas needs, 50% of them. And naturally, under the present circumstances, when we hear that the Israeli President Shimon Peres says that Hosni Mubarak has been the most loyal friend of Israel, then naturally, he has said this on publicly. He has said this on television,
he's sort of throwing down the gauntlet.
Exactly, and he's the Israeli lobby in U.S. Incidentally, also the Saudi lobby in U.S. have been actively involved in trying to convince Obama and his officials that they should not press Mubarak any further, because if he were to go, it is going to lead to chaos in Egypt. As if to say there isn't enough chaos in Egypt right now. And he hasn't been, you know, everything has been safe and sound for the people.
They have state chaos going on.
Absolutely, yes.
This is Zafar Bengash. We won't keep you much longer. We know you have to go. Zafar is crescent-online.net. Cynthia McKinney is coming on February the 12th, Saturday, at 6 p.m., to get a ticket, $25 for a meal, and to get to hear the great Cynthia McKinney, 905-887-8913. And Zafar, in fairness to the Vice President, Mr. Suleiman, I want to ask you this. That torture of people and his involvement with what was called rendition, he was being in a U.S. employee.
Absolutely.
I mean, we really ought to say to the boss, you know, we're not terribly interested in him.
Yes, exactly.
Why did you direct that Egyptian to torture people for you?
He was, you put it very nicely. Yes, he was a direct employee of the U.S., and that's why he was and he remains so popular both in the U.S. as well as in Israel, because whatever they wanted him to do in terms of torturing people, breaking people's fingers or pulling their nails out or electrocuting them, or, you know, they would make them stand naked for hours on end.
Yes, and this was Bush and Cheney and identified individuals who, by the way, even endorsed rendition, and Mr. Obama has not given up on that.
Exactly.
You know, if you had a conspiracy, a trial for conspiracy to commit torture, they would be heading the list of indictees, because it was their plan.
Exactly. You know, I want to mention to you, and I think something that your listeners would take heart from, that George Bush was supposed to speak in Geneva on February the 12th. He was invited there by some Zionist organization. He was going to speak at their gala dinner. But to the credit of the people in Switzerland as well as human rights organizations, they actually launched a case against George Bush. And they were going to, in fact, today they were supposed to submit documents to court charging Bush with war crimes.
Good. And they could have subpoenaed Mr. Suleiman as a witness.
Exactly. And Bush decided not to go to Geneva next Saturday. I would have invited him to Toronto, but for the fact that he has been involved in these extraordinary renditions and torturing people. He has publicly admitted on television that he gave authorization to waterboard people. So that's why we are not going to have him here. That's why instead we are having Cynthia McKinney, who incidentally was the first person in the U.S. Congress to call for impeaching George Bush as a war criminal. So I think, you know, we have the right person for our program.
You do indeed. Absolutely. But, and I better give you one last, I better ask you one last question. I know that you've got an article about Tunisia. If you could just say in closing that the situation in Tunisia has not, it still has a lot of bumps on the road.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I would say that unfortunately the old guard are still in place. They have not relinquished power. What they have done is just co-opted a few of the opposition members, and nothing has changed. Of course, theoretically, they have shut down the former ruling party, the Dasturian party, but that means nothing because its members are still in power. The Secret Service is still there. The police force, 180,000 police, are still going around. Yesterday, in fact, and the day before, there were demonstrations in many Tunisian cities. Yesterday, four people were killed by police firing because they were demonstrating and they were demanding that the government should resign, the president and the prime minister, because they still belong to the old party. So, unfortunately, there are only cosmetic changes in Tunisia, not real changes.
And what's the name of the party that is sort of at issue? They're not releasing their members, and as far as I know, their leader hasn't yet returned from abroad.
No, actually, he returned actually last Saturday. Friday, he returned to Tunisia, and he was given a hero's welcome at Tunis Airport. Tens of thousands of people came to welcome him. He's, of course, the party is Al Nahda Party, which is the most organized. Although officially it has been banned since 1987, it has, like, for 23 years, that party hasn't existed officially. Thousands of its members have been, you know, thrown in jail. Thousands have been forced into exile. Hundreds of its members are still in prison, despite the amnesty. That amnesty does not extend to members of Al Nahda Party, although their leader has now returned from exile, where he was
and
in England.
The most credible party, and the one with, if you were to have a democratic exercise, would probably prevail somehow.
That is correct.
So they need their members out and representing the people.
That's right, yes.
Zafar Benghash, we're very grateful, very informative. We're going to have to stay with us, and we're all excited that Cynthia McKinney is coming here on Saturday, February 12th, 6 p.m., at the Islamic Society of York Region, 1380 Stouffville Road, Richmond Hill. $25 for a dinner ticket and a chance to see Cynthia McKinney and hear her report on the Middle East. And the number to call is 905-887-8913. Zafar, again, we're really grateful.
Thank you, Phil. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Zafar Benghash, and the website is crescent-online.net. Full of information, and I just mentioned, by the way, Press TV cairo.ir/live. If you want to know what's going on in Cairo and the world, go there. That's where George Galloway has a program on that site, by the way. I saw it last night. Very good. And Phil, what did you make of that? But I asked you to bring an article today.
Yes, this is the Israeli view, and of course this is the website of an Israeli
Before you go to that, I wonder if we could might take a quick break. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And did I say the website, taylor-report.com? Anyhow, we'll be back in just a moment.
This is CIUC 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station. Available across Canada on Star Choice National Satellite Service, Channel 826, and broadcasting worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
And we're back, just like I said, Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. With me is Phil Conlon. And Phil, one of the great figures in Israeli politics, Yuri Avneri, if there's a walking saint in that country, it's him. By the way, one of the most eloquent people and a self-confessed former terrorist, rough guy.
Yeah, he actually said that.
In his latest article, he talks about it. He served in the army. Yeah. He knew all the great figures, but he is one who's been for a long time advocating mutual respect and a reasonable solution of all the questions of the Middle East. And he's written an article, and you have it in your hands, so why don't you read some of that to us?
Sure.
This is Phil Conlon.
The article is called A Villa in the Jungle, which is actually a quote from an Israeli leader.
Mr. Barak.
Yeah, that's right, characterizing what Israel is, right? Yeah. So I'll just pick up in the article. It says, while in neighboring Egypt, earth-shattering events were taking place, Israel was absorbed with a scandal in the Army High Command. The Minister of Defense abhors the incumbent chief of staff and makes no secret of it. The presumptive new chief was exposed as a liar and his appointment canceled. These were the headlines. But what is happening now in Egypt will change our lives. As usual, nobody foresaw it. The much-feted Mossad was taken by surprise, as was the CIA and all the other celebrated services of this kind. The turmoil in Egypt was caused by economic factors: the rising cost of living, the poverty, the unemployment, the hopelessness of the educated young. But let there be no mistake, the underlying causes are far more profound, and they can be summed up in one word: Palestine. In Arab culture, nothing is more important than honor. People can suffer deprivation, but they will not stand humiliation. Yet what every young Arab from Morocco to Oman saw daily was his leader humiliating themselves, forsaking their Palestinian brothers in order to gain favor and money from America, collaborating with the Israeli occupation, cringing before the new colonizers. And so, and that's a great, I mean, because of course that's the big unspoken issue in the middle of all this. Yes. And I think people have always said that when Egypt goes, I mean, the Palestinian problem will get resolved, right?
Yes, people say, well, they would tear up the peace agreement. Well, who knows if they would, but one thing they would say is we're not going to continue to allow the Gazans to be treated the way they are. This way this issue has always gone is that, well, you know, either the Arab leadership provides people who completely agree with Washington, either, you know, you go down that road, or you're out of the game. You're a bad person. You're an extremist. But there are issues that really are supposed to be resolved there. How about the word roadmap? You know what an expression that has cobwebs on it?
Oh boy.
I mean, what roadmap? What I would say, and incidentally, Thomas Friedman in the New York Times actually said it. He said, you better start getting these agreements settled. Because, see, they don't understand. There's a part of the oxygen feeding the fire is terrible treatment of the people of Gaza and of the non-resolution issue of the West Bank and recognition of the Palestinians' right to self-determination in the state, etc. And everybody just treats it as a joke and says that can wait. Well, you know, this things like what happened in Tunisia and what happened in Egypt, that happens because you say you'll have to wait. You remember, by the way, Phil, the civil rights movement.
Oh, that was always
the slogan.
Don't go so fast, you know. Just tomorrow, you know, but not today. And that was
maybe someday.
Yeah, someday. And that was, of course, what was great about Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. They said, no, absolutely not today. Right,
we're
it
not
has
waiting
to be today. We're not waiting. You know.
Yeah, that was a title of Martin Luther King's. He wrote one or two books, actually, collected speeches. Brilliant man, and that was why we cannot wait. We are not waiting, and I can recall sainted liberals, so-called, of the past, like Adlai Stevenson, was asked about African independence, countries, the self-determination. He said, "Well, when they're ready for democracy." Well, of course, we started off today's program with the right question. Is America ready for democracy? Because that was really the question the black movement raised in America. Are you ready for democracy or not? Enough of this talk. We had on this program Lee Lorch only a few weeks ago. And Lee Lorch, a World War II Army veteran, came home to a segregated New York City where you could be get a new apartment if you were a war veteran, but not if you were a black war veteran. Because they said, no, we don't do it that way. So the question was, are you ready for democracy? And the answer at that time was no. And the answer at the moment seems to be no. And black Americans would say, you know what, it's still no. The prisons are full of African Americans. In every category that is measurable in American demographics, you will find discrimination. So domestic policy is foreign policy. That's no question in my mind. But anyway, that's a brilliant article by Yuri Avneri. And that quote that he began the article with, maybe near the end he identifies the author, but that's a former prime minister of Israel.
That's right. And actually, why don't I just read the last two paragraphs. And this is how he sums up everything the Israeli leadership has done in the last 44 years of occupation or 63 years of its existence is becoming obsolete. We are facing a new reality. We can ignore it, insisting that we are a villa in the jungle, as Ehud Barak famously put it, or find our proper place in the new reality. Peace with the Palestinians is no longer a luxury. It is an absolute necessity. Peace now, peace quickly. Peace with the Palestinians, and then peace with the democratic masses all over the Arab world. Peace with the reasonable Islamic forces like Hamas and the Muslim Brothers. Mm-hmm. Peace with the leaders who are about to emerge in Egypt and everywhere else.
Yeah, that's Yuri Avneri. By the way, if you Google his name, can you spell his name out for everybody?
Avneri is A-V-N-E-R-Y. His first name is Yuri, U-R-I. His website is Zope, Z-O-P-E dot gushshalom.org.
That's a peace organization.
Yeah.
And by the way, he, I believe, is in his 80s now. Everybody who's seen him tells me he's a very tall, handsome man, very eloquent, and he's one who goes and demonstrates to this day. I mean, he does, just a tremendous figure. And you know, whenever there's any major activity in the Middle East, I always go to see what Yuri Avneri says. Because what wonderful credentials. He was an actual fighter. I mean, he actually was part of the, I think it was the Irgun.
Right.
But he was a...
Who were, to be fair, fighting the British, right? So, I mean, we can
among other people.
Among other people, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, to give them their due. Yeah. Well, of course.
Yeah.
It's a very confused, long story, and he's one of the confused, long individuals who graduated from it. He knows everyone, and therefore he speaks with a calm authority. You know, he didn't have to look it up. He was there. So Yuri Avneri has written a brilliant piece. That thing about being a villa in the jungle. Yes. What former Prime Minister of Israel? That's
Barak.
Barak.
Yeah.
And he was just. He said that's what Israel is. We're in the Middle East. We are a villa in the jungle.
It's an odd imagery for a place that has a lot of desert, right?
Well, the Toronto Star, by the way, which is incredibly hilarious to me, they just are going to great lengths. They interviewed an expert to find out what was going on, and it was an Israeli intellectual. That's how they identified him, an Israeli intellectual who said, this is not about Islam. This is about Arabs, something of that sort, and they what they don't understand and what they understand. And then he said, we in the West And I thought, you know, this could be, maybe we're at the nub of a problem. Last time I looked,
West, right?
Israel was not in the West.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you say that, maybe you're putting your finger on a problem. And you, thank you very much for helping. Although that wasn't what the star thought they were doing. By the way, there. You know, I thought of a funny metaphor, but I think it's funny. There's a. If you want to find truffles, I understand that you get a what is called a truffle hog, because truffles are very hard to find, and so you put him on a leash, and the hog hunts and hunts and finds this very difficult thing. And last week after our program, I was driving home and I was listening to CBC. And they, their reporter in Cairo had found a Mubarak supporter in a poor neighborhood who'd been hit with a rock. And he said he wasn't blaming Mubarak. He just blamed the policeman who threw the rock or something like that. Or the and I said to myself, now there's a truffle hawk, see? That reporter was able in Cairo. I mean, there's somebody who, you know, called home to Toronto and said, hey, I found something. I found a Mubarak supporter. Yeah. And they said, good, we'll go with that. And that was the lead item on the news. I was, I could not believe my ears.
Well,
yes, I could.
Of course,
I could
believe my ears. The truffle hog, of course, gets no thanks because even though he will find the truffle hog, he's never allowed to eat it, right?
Oh, well, now you see, you're getting at the true nature of the system. You will work and dig this thing up, and I will eat that. That sounds like the system I've heard about. I'm going to look that up. And speaking of looking up systems, there is a, we have some Green Bay news that we have to tell you about. Dave Zirin's written a good piece.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
But there's another gentleman who seems to be a friend of Zirin, and I think he's poaching on Zirin territory because he's written a piece today called Socialism Triumphs at the Super Bowl as Class War Looms. And his story is that Green Bay is a publicly owned team. Now, when we interviewed Dave Zirin, that's one of the things we pointed out. The Green Bay is kind of like the truffle hunting hog. It is actually a city of 100,000. That's fewer than Hamilton. And it is on the top of the National Football League. And it is owned by the people. And you know, when it snows too much before a game, in Green Bay, they call the citizens and say, our team is going to be playing Sunday, and we need to shovel the parking lot, and people come and do it.
And sometimes the stadium itself, it snows on the seats, and people go in and
get the stadium ready.
Yeah. And they don't get paid for
so
it.
So which system works? And you know, they were so successful that they're simply a legal exception in the NFL. Everybody else has to be owned by a guy, a corporation, a billionaire. And then the billionaire sits in a seat in a glass-encased box with George Bush or somebody like that, and the cameras play on him as though he's an artistic object. And then people pay for these damn stadiums for them, and then they treat the people like dirt. I mean, we live in Toronto under the curse of the Smythes and the Ballards. If you want to free yourself, we should say Toronto should own the team. That way we can say that's our team. Otherwise, it's his team. If he wants to move the team, he can move it. But you can't move Green Bay. And it has 100,000 people and the best football team there is. So anyway, good for them. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And if you want to check us out, taylor-report.com. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And Phil, now I got to tell you, this is our Black History Month. There's a great story from Richmond. Richmond, again, I'm going to tell everybody, is the capital of the Confederacy, and it fell in 1865, and slavery ended, and Abraham Lincoln visited Richmond, a very well-kept secret in America, by the way. No, very few Americans know that Lincoln went to see the captured capital, and when he got off the boat, there were no army ready to greet him, but there were a bunch of freed slaves who came and had a conversation with him. So it's a very important place, largely ignored because in America you can start a fistfight by mentioning Civil War properly. But here's what happened. There's a place in Richmond called Hollywood Cemetery. That's the name of it. It's Hollywood. And in that cemetery there are 22 Confederate generals. And also, I think the man himself, Jeff Davis, president of the slave system, and they're very much honored. There's also a Boulevard of Heroes where you can see Lee on his horse and Stonewall Jackson on his horse, and all this honor, honor, honor. Well, the black population and people who believe in this, in the human rights for all Americans, have been restive with this phenomenon, because there's another cemetery in Richmond. It's a cemetery of former slaves and freedmen, African Americans, except it has no marker. But it's there, and everyone knows its extent because it's a huge cemetery, because slavery system buried a lot of African Americans. They buried people like Michael Vick and Ray Charles, all these great people, their forebears who never got to realize their potential and realize their potential on behalf of the whole country. They're buried there. And most of them had chains on them in their lives. Most of them were whipped. And of course, men, women, and children, it's a mass grave in a sense, because there's no markers. Now, the African American population and other civil rights people in Richmond have had a campaign to mark this as a historic site. It turns out that the property is owned by a university there. I'm not going to attempt to say which one it is. It's Virginia something. And they have, at the cemetery, most of the cemetery is a parking lot. And so this has given rise to one of the great slogans. And I love this slogan, but I'll tell you what happened. They began to have marches. And we're going to follow up on this. We're going to be talking to people who organize these things. But they began to have marches and demands. We want that cemetery returned to its proper status. We want it recognized that, you know, over in Hollywood, you've got 22 guys who fought for slavery, the generals, and you honor them. And meanwhile, you have put a parking lot over the graves of the people they victimized and fought to hold down and fought to enslave. I'm going to throw in something here. I just read a South Carolina politician, when he stood up to say why South Carolina was leaving the Union, he said, give me slavery or give me death. That was his slogan. So they have that cemetery. And there is the one, the unmarked one. So they had a big rally, and they had a march, and they went over. And if you go, I think it's I-95 going north and south through Virginia. That highway runs right through the slave cemetery, the unmarked
one. The I-95.
Yeah, and over that parking lot. So they had a meeting there. Yeah. Had a meeting. And they had many speakers saying, we're going to stay with this until we have gotten rid of that parking lot and put a proper marker. So they had about five or six speakers. But a chant had been developing all day long. And every time one of these intellectuals or anybody from the community got up to give their speech, they had to join the crowd, primarily African American, in the chant. And the chant words are, get your asphalt off our people. Isn't that a great song?
That's a great
get
song.
Get your asphalt off our people. And good for them. And since this is...
You could turn the... If they need a parking lot, you could take that other cemetery with the 22 generals. You could pay that one over there.
Well, of course, a couple of speakers said, I tell you what, we'll trade with you. You want to put asphalt on our people, let's go and put asphalt on Hollywood Cemetery. I mean, what is this? Now we're back to the, you know, Martin Luther King, why we can't wait. This is maddening. You know, why do people go mad? Because of that kind of, you know, we have to listen to silliness, the message to Congress or interviews with big shots, and they always invoke democracy and equal rights. And you say, hey, listen, so long as you have a unrecognized slave cemetery in the heart of Richmond, which was the capital of slaveocracy, and you don't clean that up and put appropriate monument there, I would suggest a figure with the shackles broken off. That's what I would suggest. As long as you don't do that, please don't give me any speeches about how interested you are in freedom of anybody.
Phil, you might have noticed this week was the 150th anniversary of the secession of Texas from the Union. And a friend of mine who lives in Texas posted on Facebook the declaration that Texas made when they left the Union. And they said...
It was a short message.
It was a very short message. It said was, this Texas was founded by the white race for the white race, and the colored races had nothing to do with it, and they have nothing to say about its future. And that was the rationale given by the people in Texas who led the secession, and so they made it very clear that that's what they were fighting for. There was no question of states' rights. They'd only been a state for a few years.
Right to do what?
This was a state for the white race, and that is the language that they used.
Yes, it's very important to point that out. Yeah. That's why all the great commentators on the American Civil War say it was the second revolution. Yeah. It was the issue of is the Declaration about all people being created equal, or is that true or not? Now, Alexander Stevens, one of the SOB's top guys of the kind of slaveocracy, gave a speech to rally the slave states, and he said, we have to clarify that. Jefferson, he said, was wrong to say that, because, in fact, we have a racial system, and we have to inferior peoples can't share in power. But he said that was like a stupid, overzealous statement by Mr. Jefferson. So we, the Confederacy, are going to correct that. It's very important. People wonder why we're talking about this. This is Black History Month, to underline the fact you better know what these struggles are about. And because this is the anniversary of the beginning of the war. April the 12th will be the anniversary of the beginning of the war, which led to the, after 4 years of fighting, led to the death, destruction of slavery, but not, of course, to the end of racism by any stretch. However, those who fought and defended the slaveocracy have now tried to re-exhibit themselves as, they were just, for states' rights, or it had to do with taxes or something. And I think we should identify the area. There's debate about this, but the so-called Tea Party phenomenon roots itself in this falsification of history. When they talk about the good old days of the original America, they mean the original America in which there were 4 million African slaves. 4 million. So it's very important for us to, and we will be focusing. But we're definitely going to stay with the story about the Richmond people who's chanting and still chanting, "Get your asphalt off our people." I see we're coming to the end of time. What do you know? It was great to have Zephyr Benkash. Phil Connor, thank you very much. And it was that piece from Yuri Avneri of Israel, brilliant piece. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. I remind you, write to us, taylor@cit.fm, and check us out, taylor-report.com. Laura Louise, we are very grateful, and we'll be with you next week.